This is Talking to America. I'm your host, Aaron Zellman. Our special guest today is David T. Hardy, attorney, author, and scholar. Today we're going to be talking about a very important court decision. It's called the Parker case. As the decision stands now, a particular court has said that you have an individual right to own a firearm versus the story that the gun control folks have put out about it's a collective right. So, David, let me start by asking you, how did the Parker lawsuit come to be?
Well, it was brought by a couple of attorneys, Bob Levy and Alan Gura, who thought they could challenge the District of Columbia law, which prohibits handguns and requires long guns to be kept disassembled or trigger locked. And they essentially decided to bring the lawsuit in the District of Columbia federal court and to challenge it in that venue.
Why would you suggest that they pick the District of Columbia?
I think that was a very, very intelligent choice. There are several reasons. One is that when they went on appeal from there to the Circuit Court of Appeals, the next rung up, the D.C. Circuit was one of relatively few federal circuits that had no prior decisions on the Second Amendment. Most circuits, if you went up, what would happen would be no matter how convincing your argument is, they go back to, well, we've previously ruled that the Second Amendment is not an individual right, and we're going to stand by that precedent, and you have a convincing argument, but we're bound by our prior decision, so go away. D.C. Circuit, that isn't true. They didn't have a decision on the Second Amendment being an individual right one way or the other. The other thing is that in most gun laws, if you want to challenge them, are at the state level. With the states, you have it's a bit difficult to explain, but it's called the incorporation issue. The Second Amendment, like most of the federal Bill of Rights, actually was adopted as part of the federal Constitution. And the Supreme Court, over 100 years ago, ruled that the federal Bill of Rights only affects Congress, only affects the federal government. If you want to have an individual right against your state, you ought to put it in your state constitution. That changed under the 14th Amendment, 1868, and it was a very complex process, but basically the Supreme Court started saying that some of the rights under the Federal Bill of Rights actually do apply against the states. But it's never got around to saying that the Second Amendment does. So if you're challenging a state law, you have that problem, that the court can also brush you off by saying, well, the Supreme Court has never said the Second Amendment applies to states, so go away. If you challenge the District of Columbia law, you don't have that problem because D.C. is entirely a federal creation. It's not a state. The third reason was why it was such a good pick was that D.C. has such an absolute law. I mean, you can debate, whether this is a this law or that law is a reasonable regulation of a right. It's pretty hard in the case of D.C. to argue that because it totally bans ownership of handguns and requires that long arms be kept either disassembled or trigger locked, so they're useless for self-defense. It's very, very difficult to argue that the D.C. law is anything like a reasonable regulation. It's an outright ban. So for all those three reasons, I think D.C. was an excellent target for a lawsuit of this type.
Well, okay, why don't we talk about then what the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled?
Well, the D.C. Circuit essentially took the case and ruled that in terms stronger than the Emerson decision, which came from the Fifth Circuit some years ago, ruled that the Second Amendment is an individual right, that it does pertain to individual citizens, that it applies to D.C., and that the D.C. law is unconstitutional. They made some reference to the fact that maybe a reasonable regulation is allowed, but then said there's no way you can class this as reasonable regulation. It was, a stunning opinion. It went farther than Emerson. It actually struck down the law, which Emerson didn't. The Emerson case essentially, out of the Fifth Circuit, which is Texas and Louisiana, had said that this is an individual right, but then it said that the gun law at issue, the federal ban on domestic violence, restraining orders or conviction. I think restraining orders said, well, this is about as far as you can go and still call it a reasonable regulation of a right, but we're going to allow it. So the Emerson case out of the Fifth Circuit upheld the gun law in question, even though it said it wasn't, the Second Amendment was an individual right. Well, the D.C. Circuit went farther. Yeah, it's an individual right, and we're striking down this law. For that reason, I think Parker is a stunning decision. It is a stunning ruling in favor of gun owners.
I'm wondering, what kind of feedback are you getting from other attorneys and people in the pro-gun movement concerning the Parker case?
For the most part, everyone is happy to have Parker. The only division is between those who think, who rejoice that it may go to the Supreme Court and those who worry that it may go to the Supreme Court and those who do both. That sort of thing. I mean, anytime you're talking about an appeal, you're rolling the dice, and you're never quite sure how the dice are going to turn up. So that's the division there. You know, do you worry about it or do you rejoice about it?
Well, do you think the D.C. Circuit Court is going to appeal to the Supreme Court, filing a petition for certiorari?
Well, yeah, it wouldn't be the D.C., but the D.C. government itself, the defendant. Will they? I would have said almost certainly. Now I don't know. There's some articles in the Washington Post where both the Post and the D.C. government sounds like they're scared, worried about the outcome, as they should be. And there is an outside chance that they wouldn't take the appeal. I think it's only an outside chance because they've got so much invested in it emotionally and otherwise. To just roll over and die on it, they would have, first of all, they'd appear in the eyes of the world as losers who were scared of taking it to the Supreme Court because they knew they'd lose, which would be the truth. Secondly, they'd lose their precious gun law, which, while it hasn't done any good for anyone, in their eyes, they have an emotional investment there. So the other thing from the general anti-gun side is that D.C. Circuit isn't just a circuit court of appeals. You have jurisdiction to sue the federal government in D.C. Circuit anytime you want, even though the harm to you occurred in California or Nevada or Alaska. You can sue where you were hurt, or you can sue the federal government in D.C. It's as if the federal government lives in D.C. You can always go to a person and sue them where they live. If you let this precedent stand, you've got precedent in D.C. that it's an individual right, and every single federal gun law is wide open to challenge in that court. So I tend to think they're going to take it up, that they're going to move in the Supreme Court for certiorari. I can't guarantee it. They may chicken out at the last minute, you might say.
Okay, well, would they be chickening out because of the points that you've made here?
Yeah, that was just what the Post was saying.
Yeah.
Complaining that, this is it's a conservative court now, and maybe they don't want to take it up. No, it's no more conservative than it was beforehand. It's just that you're scared.
Well, while you're on that point about a conservative court, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the court that thinks the Patriot Act is okay, and this is the court that had the eminent domain ruling, which is horrendous, and this is the court that doesn't seem to have a problem with the warrantless tapping of people's phones. So why would they be enthused about individuals having a right to own firearms?
Well, I don't know if Roberts and Alito were there for all of those rulings, but, it's hard to pretend there's any great consistency in the Constitution and its interpretation by the court. But I think that clearly some of the... I think we've got four votes there. The question is, do we have a fifth? I mean, there's no question Clarence Thomas is very pro-Second Amendment. Alito has published a book in which he mentions the Second Amendment very favorably. And I think Roberts, from his confirmation testimony, seems favorable to the Second Amendment, and there's some word that Alito is. So that I count as four. Do we have a fifth? I don't know. But, you know, the Second Amendment is something that crosses a great many divides, where you can have persons who are very much on the liberal left or the conservative right, and both forms of the conservative right, the libertarian right and the rules right, as I call them, all supporting the Second Amendment.
In the small print of the Parker decision, they made it pretty clear, or quite clear, that it's an individual right, but government has a right to control and regulate firearms. Am I correct about that?
Yeah.
Now, we take this to the Supreme Court, and suppose they agree with the Parker decision. Sure, you have a right, but government can control it. And I can just see governments throughout America, especially in California or New York, Chicago, D.C., saying, well, sure, you've got a right, but here's some reasonable controls on it. And when they get done being reasonable, they'll have turned a right into a mere privilege.
Well,
and I wonder if people are really thinking about this. Maybe I'm the odd duck here.
No. Any Supreme Court ruling is just going to be the start of the fight. I mean, if you get this is an individual right, okay, now we start the legal battle. If you look at the battle for civil rights in the courts, I mean, that starts in at the highest levels in the 1950s, gets off to a very slow start, several decisions. You finally build up to Brown versus School Board in the early 60s. Then you have a whole set of battles in the circuit courts throughout the late 60s, early 70s. Same with the Warren Court change around in rights of criminal suspects. You know, that was a process that took about 10 or 15 years to evolve. It would be the same here. You start out with the Supreme Court ruling, and then you get down to the actual fighting over what in the heck does this mean. It'll be 10 or 20 years easily in that process. And, yes, there will be arguments, this is reasonable, that is reasonable, and those will be fought out one at a time, and probably for the first 5 years of it, the Supreme Court won't touch it. It'll let everybody else fight it out so it doesn't have to stick its neck out. Then it would take a case or two and say, no, that's not okay. Yes, this is okay. I mean, what we're really looking for would be something like the treatment of First Amendment rights, freedom of speech, where, yes, you can put some regulations on it. However, they are very few and far between. They are highly suspect. You better have an extremely good reason why you needed it, and it better be as narrow as you possibly could use in order to meet that need. So, you know, we could come off with something like that, or we could come off with what we've seen in a number of areas like economic activity, where reasonable regulation amounts to whatever the legislature dang well pleases. But, you know, that's the battle. If we win in the Supreme Court in Parker, that'd be the battle of the next 10, 15, 20 years.
Okay, well, and it's good that gun owners understand 15 or 20 years before nirvana comes upon us.
Yes.
So, or even after that, I suppose they could still say that you can, or the government can still have some form of regulation for firearms. We'll have to wait 15 or 20 years to see what happens there. Okay, well, how long do these folks have to approach the court, and then when do you think the court would likely decide whether to take the case?
They have 90 days to file a petition for certiorari, which is the technical way you take an appeal to the Supreme Court in this setting. So you have 90 days to file the petition. I forget exactly when Parker came down, but I guess we've got about another 60 days, so that'd probably put them into June or July. And you need all that time, by the way, since your any filings with the Supreme Court have to be printed, I mean, at a printing establishment, and have to be absolutely perfect, no typos allowed, that sort of thing. So it takes all that time. But let's say they have to file in June or July, then by then the Supreme Court will be out of session. They take a summer break up until the first Monday in October. So they'll file in June or July. If there's opposition, it'll be filed over the summer, and then finally the Supreme Court will come back in the first Monday in October, and we'll probably hear about it shortly thereafter.
Okay, suppose the Supreme Court decides not to take the case. Where do we go from there?
Start picking out federal gun laws that are particularly oppressive and file a challenge to them in D.C.
What particular federal gun control laws do you think are quite oppressive?
We'd have to find the most extreme cases. Maybe the domestic violence restraining order. Take another shot at that, although Emerson did uphold it. Things like that. You know, you're looking for as close as you can come to it, something that absolutely bans a gun or a gun type and applies preferably to a broad swath of people.
Well, what about the ban on the new manufacture of machine guns?
You wouldn't want that to be the first challenge. I mean, you're looking at getting a toehold and gradually expanding it. If I was on the court and you challenged a new manufacturer of machine guns, you'd get my vote. But I'm not like most judges. There might be a tendency to go up there, well, we are talking about machine guns. Surely that's a reasonable regulation. You're looking for something where, some corner where you can get another ruling that, nah, there's no way in heck this can be classed as reasonable.
Okay. This is Talking to America. Our guest today is David T. Hardy, author and scholar. David has produced many books and films, including his latest, In Search of the Second Amendment. And I'm your host, Aaron Zellman. David, all that we've talked about now, what is your best guess as to who would win and if they do?
I think we win. The pro-gun side wins. I can't tell you exactly who, and it's by no means a sure thing, but I think we've got 4 votes in our favor, and all we have to do is pick up one more to get 5 votes of majority. And I think there's a 5th vote out there somewhere. So I think we win.
Who would you speculate is the 5th vote?
Kennedy's the traditional swing. I can't tell you, you know, that he's pro-Second Amendment. I've been doing some looking into the court, and I can't find any specific indications as to how he thinks. Curiously enough, Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the liberal wing has had at least one ruling where she mentioned the Second Amendment favorably in passing. And I forget exactly what it was, but it was just something that brought it in with other individual rights. That could just be coincidence.
Was this there was a decision dealing with the interpretation of the people?
Yeah, I
believe
it was.
Could that have been it?
That could have been. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, that could just be coincidental drafting and doesn't reflect her real feelings, or it might reflect her real choice.
What do you think the other side is thinking about right now? You know, the Sarah Brady crowd. You think they're worried? Should they be worried?
They're scared out of their minds, and they should be. I mean, it's if we make this breakthrough, it's by, as I've said, by no means the end of the issue. It just starts into the battle of reasonable regulation. But from their standpoint, it'll be a big morale blow. I mean, suddenly it's recognized that they're attacking a constitutional right, and they have to fall back on, well, we're just putting a few reasonable regulations on it, but still there's the morale change in, but you're attacking a constitutional right, people. They would be fearful of that.
I know several people who are pro-gun control, And after the Parker decision came out, I thought it'd be curious to see what they have to say, and most interesting, and they were just silent.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. I mean, they just got kicked in the gut, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're scared. And, like I say, demoralized.
What should our side be worried about, though?
Well, there's always the worry of losing. Like I say, I'm pretty sure of four votes, but if all five remaining go against us, we could lose.
If we lose, then what?
Well, you know, that's the funny part. If we lose, as a practical matter, it doesn't hurt us a great deal. If the other side loses, it hurts them a great deal. If it hurts us, if we lose, well, to tell you the truth, how many politicians out there, apart from Ron Paul probably, refuse to vote for gun control because they think it's unconstitutional, even though they really like the idea? Okay.
Are you going to run that by me again?
How many politicians out there think gun control is a good idea and they'd like to vote for it, but they're not going to vote for it because they think it's unconstitutional?
I don't know of any who would have that kind of an approach. You think that's what Ron Paul is thinking about? That?
Well, actually, I think he probably isn't an exception either. I think he probably thinks gun control is stupid, and so he wouldn't vote for it even if it was constitutional. But what I'm saying is the number of politicians who vote against it based purely upon their view of the Constitution is probably zero. So from our standpoint, even if we lose in the Supreme Court, it doesn't really change the equation much. I mean, politicians will either vote our way out of a judgment that gun laws are stupid, or they fear what would happen among the voters, or they won't. And whether it's constitutional or unconstitutional won't change that calculus any. So as a practical matter, I don't know that it actually changes. Obviously, winning it would help us. But losing it, I don't know if it changes the calculus a great deal on whether gun laws get passed or not.
If we were to lose, would it simply encourage the Brady Group?
Yeah, it would encourage them.
And judges who are sympathetic to them?
Yeah, they'd feel somewhat freer to move for gun control and that sort of thing. But I don't think it would change the picture in the legislature any. So, yeah, it would be a morale blow to us and a help to them.
Speaking of them, the Brady Group, can we just spend a moment helping people understand the strange position they take that gun ownership is a collective right? So that people better understand the mentality and thinking of the Brady crowd.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's hard to explain reasonably, but the traditional argument against, you might say, against the Second Amendment goes like this. The first part of the Second Amendment talks about a well-regulated militia. Therefore, that must be all that it's concerned with. Therefore, this right of the people to keep and bear arms should only be understood as allowing a state to have a well-regulated militia, which in the modern day means the National Guard. So this is all about allowing the states to have National Guard-type units, and that's all that it is, and it doesn't have anything to do with whether you can own a handgun in the District of Columbia as an individual. That would be just about the core of the collective right thing. Lately, Professor Saul Cornell has tried to evolve what you could call a sophisticated collective rights view, which is more like the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right to own guns. However, it only applies to you if you are in some way connected to a well-regulated militia, which achieves the same effect.
Well, they need to look at an old dictionary from many, many years ago where the term regulated talks about well-drilled and prepared and has nothing to do with government control.
Oh, yeah. I found a reference to it in the 1600s, a well-regulated troops, meaning troops that were properly disciplined and knew how to do what they had to do.
Well, you and I had a chance to work on a project together. It's a documentary film called The Gang. You were the script writer, and I was the guy who simply paid the bills. No, it's known as the producer. Mm-hmm. But the purpose of The Gang is to put the 68 Gun Control Act and the BATFE on trial, expose their nasty past, and try to encourage Americans to come to the conclusion that This is an agency that has outlived its usefulness, if it ever was useful. And I'm just wondering, how is the gang going to work with what's happening with Parker, whatever way the Parker decision goes, whatever the Supreme Court rules or doesn't rule? And how can people use the gang to help many other people, including gun owners, understand why gun control in America must be abolished?
I think the gang is more useful in the PR realm than in the courtroom. Obviously, we can't get the Supreme Court to sit down and watch it. But in terms of achieving public relations, it can be important. I mean, the civil rights movement in the South owed a great deal to things like Bull O'Connor, was it Bull Connor? Now I forget which. You know, attacking civil rights protesters with attack dogs and water hoses, because it brought the issue to everybody's attention and showed who were the real oppressors. And that started changing the public opinion, which in turn changed the angle the courts were taking on it from the original process, which was you've got to desegregate, but take your time about it, you know, whatever the phrase was, all due speed, all due, not forgotten, but it was something that left some leeway. That sort of response played a role in eventually turning the court around to decide that all due deliberation meant, no, you're going to end it now. And I think that's where the gang could come in terms of changing the public opinion, which in turn changes the environment in which the court will be issuing rulings in the future.
So we could say that the gang would be useful in winning hearts and minds.
Exactly.
And that's the way it should be used. I mean, that was the purpose of producing the film, and that was the structure of it. Well, we just have to remind people if they want to change hearts and minds and get rid of gun control, they'll have to watch the gang. David, we're at the end of our program, and I want to thank you very much for coming on today. This has been Talking to America. Our guest has been David Hardy. I'm your host, Aaron Zellman. And please remember, if you won't defend your rights, don't complain when you lose them.
Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of JPFO.org or its members. Talking to America is a production of JPFO.org.